Her voice caught on his name. Leo likes them. My vast experience with women told me that Calypso was either feeling remorseful about her argument with Leo yesterday, or she got emotional on the subject of tater tots. I wasn't inclined to find out which. Whatever is't the case, I knowest not. I spat the Shakespearean English off my tongue. I don't know what the arrow's advice means. Perhaps when we get to the zoo, it will make sense. Because that happens so often when we arrive in new places, Calypso said. Suddenly everything makes sense. You have a point, I sighed. But much like the point on my talking arrow, it does us no good. Shall we continue? We used the Washington Street Bridge to cross the White River, which was not at all white. It flowed wide, sluggish, and brown between cement retaining walls, the water breaking around islands of scrubby bushes like acne patches, with which I was now all too familiar. It reminded me strangely of the Tiber in Rome, another underwhelming, long-neglected river. Yet, world-altering history had been made along the banks of the Tiber. I shuddered to think what plans Commodus had for this city. And if the White River fed the canals I'd glimpsed in his throne room, his lair might be close. Which meant that his new prefect, Laterces, might already be at the zoo. I decided to walk faster. The Indianapolis Zoo was tucked away in a park just off West Washington. We crossed an empty parking lot, heading toward the turquoise marquee of the main entrance. A banner out front read, "Wildly Cute." For a moment, I thought perhaps the zoo staff had heard I was coming and decided to welcome me. Then I realized the banner was just an advertisement for koala bears. As if koalas needed advertising. Calypso frowned at the shuttered ticket booths. Nobody here. The place is locked up tight. That was the idea, I reminded her. The fewer mortals around, the better. But how do we get in? If only someone could control wind spirits and carry us over the fence. If only some god could teleport us, she countered, or snap his fingers and bring the griffins to us. I folded my arms. I'm beginning to remember why we exiled you on that island for 3,000 years. 3,568. It would have been longer if you'd had your way. I hadn't meant to start this argument again, but Calypso made it so easy. You were on a tropical island with pristine beaches, aerial servants, and a lavishly appointed cave. Which made Ogygia not a prison? I was tempted to blast her with godly power, except, well, I didn't have any. You don't miss your island, then? She blinked as if I'd thrown sand in her face. No. That's not the point. I was kept in exile. I had no one. Oh, please. You want to know what real exile feels like? This is my third time as a mortal. Stripped of my powers, stripped of immortality. I can die, Calypso. Me too, she snapped. Yes, but you chose to go with Leo. You gave up your immortality for love. You're as bad as Hemethia. I hadn't realized how much anger was behind that last shot until I let it fly. My voice resounded across the parking lot. Somewhere in the zoo, a rudely awakened tropical bird squawked in protest. Calypso's expression hardened. Right. I only meant, save it. She gazed down the perimeter of the fence. Shall we find a place to climb over? I tried to formulate a gallant apology that would also completely vindicate my position, but I decided to let the matter drop. My shout might have woken up more than the toucans. We needed to hurry. We found a breaching point where the fence was slightly lower. Even in a skirt, Calypso proved the more agile climber. She made it over the top with no problem, while I snagged my shoe on barbed wire and found myself hanging upside down. It was complete luck that I did not fall into the tiger habitat. "Shut up," I told Calypso when she pulled me free. I didn't say anything. The tiger glared at us from the other side of his enclosure glass, as if to say, "Why are you bothering me if you haven't brought me breakfast?" I'd always found tigers to be sensible creatures. Calypso and I crept through the zoo, keeping a lookout for mortals or imperial guards. Except for a zookeeper hosing down the lemur display, we saw no one. We stopped in an area that seemed to be the park's main crossroads. To our left stood a carousel. To our right, orangutans lounged in the trees of a large netted compound. Strategically placed around the plaza were several gift shops and cafes, all closed. Signs pointed toward various attractions. Ocean, plains, jungle, flights of fancy. "Flights of fancy," I said. "Surely they would file griffins under fanciful flights." Calypso scanned our surroundings. She had unnerving eyes, dark brown and intensely focused, not unlike Artemis's gaze when she took aim at a target. I suppose on Ogygia, Calypso had had many years of practice staring at the horizon, waiting for someone or something interesting to appear. "Your arrow mentioned a train," she said. "There's a sign for a train ride." "Yes, but my arrow also said something about tater tots. I think it's getting a bit warped." Calypso pointed. "There." At the nearest outdoor cafe, next to a shuttered serving window, a lunch menu was posted on the wall. I scanned the selections. 4 different kinds of tater tots? I felt overwhelmed by culinary confusion. Why would anyone need so many? Chili, sweet potato, blue? How can a tot be? I froze. For a nanosecond, I wasn't sure what had startled me. Then I realized my keen ears had picked up on a sound in the distance. A man's voice. "What is it?" Calypso asked. "Shh." I listened more intently. I hoped I might have been mistaken. Perhaps I'd simply heard some exotic bird with a gravelly croak, or the zookeeper cursing as he hosed out lemur poop. But no. Even in my diminished mortal state, my hearing was exceptional. The voice spoke again, familiar and much closer.
"You three, that way. You two with me."
I touched Calypso's jacket sleeve. "It's Latirces, the Cornhusker." The sorceress muttered another Minoan curse, naming a part of Zeus's body that I did not want to think about. "We need to hide." Unfortunately, Latirces was approaching from the way we'd come. Judging from the sound of his voice, we had only seconds before he'd arrive. The crossroads offered any number of escape routes, but all of them would be within Latirces's line of sight. Only one place was close enough to offer cover. "When in doubt," Calypso said, "tater tots." She grabbed my hand and pulled me around the back of the cafe. 13. Fast food restaurant. My life goal is realized. Any fries with that? When I was a god, I would have been pleased to have a beautiful woman pull me behind a building. But as Lester with Calypso, I was more likely to get killed than kissed. We crouched next to a stack of milk crates by the kitchen entrance. The area smelled of cooking grease, pigeon droppings, and chlorine from the nearby children's splash park. Calypso rattled the locked door, then glared at me.
"Help," she hissed. "What am I supposed to do?" "Well, now would be a good time to have a burst of godly strength."
I should never have told her and Leo about that. Once, when facing Nero at Camp Half-Blood, my superhuman power had briefly returned, allowing me to overcome the Emperor's Germani. I'd thrown one of them into the sky, where, for all I knew, he was still in low Earth orbit. But that moment had quickly passed. My strength hadn't returned since. Regardless, Leo and Calypso seemed to think I could summon godly bursts of awesomeness anytime I wanted, just because I was a former god. I found that unfair. I gave the door a try. I yanked the handle and almost pulled my fingers out of their sockets.
"Ow,"
I muttered. Mortals have gotten good at making doors. Now, back in the Bronze Age, Calypso shushed me. Our enemies' voices were getting closer. I couldn't hear Laterces, but two other men were conversing in a guttural language that sounded like ancient Gaelic. I doubted they were zookeepers. Calypso frantically pulled a bobby pin from her hair. Aha! So her lovely coiffed locks did not stay in place by magic. She pointed at me, then pointed around the corner. I thought she was telling me to flee and save myself. That would have been a sensible suggestion. Then I realized she was asking me to keep watch. I didn't know what good that would do, but I peered over the rampart of milk crates and waited for Germani to come and kill us. I could hear them at the front of the cafe, rattling the shutter over the order window, then conversing briefly with lots of grunts and grumbling. Knowing the Emperor's bodyguards, they were probably saying something like,
"Kill?
Kill.
Bash heads?
Bash heads." I wondered why Laterces had split his people into two groups. Surely they already knew where the griffins were being kept. Why then were they searching the park? Unless, of course, they were searching for intruders, specifically us. Calypso snapped her hairpin in two. She inserted the metal pieces in the door lock and began to wriggle them. Her eyes closed as if she were in deep concentration. Ridiculous, I thought. That only works in movies and Homeric epics. Click. The door swung inward. Calypso waved me inside. She yanked the pin shards out of the lock, then followed me across the threshold, gently closing the door behind us. She turned the deadbolt just before someone outside shook the handle. A gruff voice muttered in Gaelic, probably something like,
"No luck. Bash heads elsewhere."
Footsteps receded. I finally remembered to breathe. I faced Calypso. "How did you pick the lock?" She stared at the broken hairpin in her hand. I thought about weaving.
Weaving?
I can still weave. I spent thousands of years practicing at the loom. I thought maybe, I don't know, manipulating pins in a lock wouldn't be too different than weaving thread in a loom. The two things sounded very different to me, but I couldn't argue with the results. So it wasn't magic then. I tried to contain my disappointment. Having a few wind spirits at our command would have been very helpful. "No," she said. "You'll know when I get my magic back, because you'll find yourself being tossed across Indianapolis."
That's something to look forward to.
I scanned the dark interior of the snack bar. Against the back wall were the basics: a sink, a deep fryer, a stovetop, two microwaves, Under the counter sat two horizontal freezers. How did I know the basics of a fast food kitchen, you ask? I had discovered the singer Pink while she was working at McDonald's. I found Queen Latifah at Burger King. I'd spent a fair amount of time in such places. You can't discount any site where you might find talent. I checked the first freezer. Inside, wreathed in cold mist, were carefully labeled boxes of ready-to-cook meals. But nothing that read tater tots. The second freezer was locked. Calypso, I said, could you weave this open? Who's useless now, eh? In the interest of getting my way, I decided not to answer. I stepped back as Calypso worked her non-magical skills. She popped this lock even faster than the first. Well done. I lifted the freezer lid. Ah. Hundreds of packages were wrapped in white butcher paper, each labeled in black marker. Calypso squinted at the descriptions. Carnivorous horse mix? Combat ostrich cubes? And? Griffin taters. She turned to me with a horrified look. Surely they're not grinding animals into food. I remembered a long-ago banquet with the spiteful King Tantalus, who had served the gods a stew made from his own sons. With humans, anything was possible. But in this case, I didn't think the cafe was putting mythical wildlife on the menu. These items are under lock and key, I said. I'm guessing they've been set aside as treats for the zoo's rarest animals. That's a mix of food for a carnivorous horse, not a mixture of carnivorous horse. Calypso looked only slightly less nauseated. What in the world is a combat ostrich? The question triggered an old memory. I was overwhelmed by a vision as powerful as the stench of an unwashed lemur cage. I found myself lounging on a couch in the campaign tent of my friend Commodus. He was in the midst of a military campaign with his father, Marcus Aurelius. But nothing about the tent suggested the harsh life of the Roman legion. Overhead, a white silk canopy billowed in the gentle breeze. In one corner, a musician sat, discreetly serenading us with his lyre. Under our feet spread the finest rugs from the eastern provinces, each one as expensive as an entire villa in Rome. Between our two couches, a table was spread with an afternoon snack of roast boar, pheasant, salmon, and fruit spilling from a solid gold cornucopia. I was amusing myself by throwing grapes at Commodus's mouth. Of course, I never missed, unless I wanted to. But it was fun to watch the fruit bounce off Commodus's nose. You are terrible, he teased me. And you are perfect, I thought. But I merely smiled. He was 18. In mortal form, I appeared to be a youth of the same age. But even with my godly enhancements, I could hardly have been more handsome than the princeps. Despite his easy life, being born into the purple of the imperial household, Commodus was the very model of athletic perfection. His body lithe and muscular, his golden hair in ringlets around his Olympian face. His physical strength was already renowned, drawing comparisons to the legendary hero Hercules. I threw another grape. He caught it in his hand and studied the little orb. Oh, Apollo. He knew my real identity, yes. We had been friends. More than friends. For almost a month at that point. I get so weary of these campaigns. My father has been at war virtually his entire reign. Such a hard life for you. I gestured at the opulence around us. Yes, but it's ridiculous. Tromping around Danubian forests, stamping out barbarian tribes that are really no threat to Rome. What's the point of being emperor if you're never in the capital having fun? I nibbled on a piece of boar meat. Why not talk to your father? Ask for a furlough? Commodus snorted. You know what he'll do. Give me another lecture on duty and morality. He is so virtuous, so perfect, so esteemed. He put those words in air circles, since air quotes had not yet been invented. I could certainly sympathize with his feelings. Marcus Aurelius was the sternest, most powerful father in the world, aside from my own father Zeus. Both loved to lecture. Both loved to remind their offspring how lucky they were, how privileged, how far short they fell of their father's expectations. And of course, both had gorgeous, talented, tragically underappreciated sons. Commodus squished his grape and watched the juice trickle down his fingers. My father made me his junior co-emperor when I was 15, Apollo. It's stifling. All duty, all the time. Then he married me off to that horrid girl, Brutia Crispina. Who names their child Brutia? I didn't mean to laugh at the expense of his distant wife, but part of me was pleased when he talked badly about her. I wanted all his attention for myself. Well, someday you'll be the sole emperor, I said. Then you can make the rules. I'll make peace with the barbarians, he said immediately. Then we'll go home and celebrate with games. The best games. All the time. I'll gather the most exotic animals in the world. I'll fight them personally in the Colosseum. Tigers, elephants, ostriches. I laughed at that. Ostriches? Have you ever even seen an ostrich? Oh, yes. He got a wistful look in his eyes. Amazing creatures. If you trained them to fight, perhaps designed some sort of armor for them, they would be incredible. You're a handsome idiot. I threw another grape, which bounced off his forehead. A brief flash of anger washed over his face. I knew my sweet Commodus could have an ugly temper. He was a little too fond of slaughter. But what did I care? I was a god. I could speak to him in ways no one else dared. The tent flap opened. A centurion stepped inside and saluted crisply. But his face was stricken, gleaming with sweat.
Princeps, his voice quavered. It's your father. He is.
He never spoke the word dead, but it seemed to float into the tent all around us, sapping the heat from the air. The lyre player stopped on a major seventh chord. Commodus looked at me, panic in his eyes. Go, I said, as calmly as I could, forcing down my misgivings. You will always have my blessings. You will do fine. But I already suspected what would happen. The young man I knew and loved was about to be consumed by the emperor he would become. He rose and kissed me one last time. His breath smelled of grapes. Then he left the tent, walking, as the Romans would say, into the mouth of the wolf. Apollo! Calypso nudged my arm. Don't go, I pleaded. Then my past life burned away. The sorceress was frowning at me. What do you mean, don't go? Did you have another vision? I scanned the dark kitchen of the snack bar. I'm fine. What's going on? Calypso pointed to the freezer. Look at the prices.
I swallowed down the bitter taste of grapes and boar meat. In the freezer, on the corner of each white butcher paper package, a price was written in pencil. By far the most expensive, Griffin taters. $15,000 per serving. I'm not good at modern currency, I admitted. But isn't that a bit pricey for a meal? I was going to ask you the same thing, Calypso said. I know the S symbol with the line through it means American dollars, but the amount? She shrugged. I found it unfair that I was adventuring with someone as clueless as I was. A modern demigod could have easily told us, and they also would have had useful 21st century skills. Leo Valdez could repair machines. Percy Jackson could drive a car. I would even have settled for Meg McCaffrey and her garbage bag throwing prowess. Though I knew what Meg would say about our present predicament. You guys are dumb. I pulled out a packet of Griffin taters and unwrapped one corner. Inside, small frozen cubes of shredded potato gleamed with a golden metallic coating. Are tater tots usually sprayed with precious metal? I asked. Calypso picked one up. I don't think so. But Griffins like gold. My father told me that ages ago. I shuddered. I recalled her father, General Atlas, unleashing a flock of griffins on me during the Titans' first war with the gods. Having your chariot swarmed by eagle-headed lions is not something you easily forget. So we take these taters to feed the griffins? I guessed. With luck, this will help us win their trust. I pulled the arrow of Dodona from my quiver. Is that what you had in mind, most frustrating of arrows? The arrow vibrated.
Verily, thou art denser than a combat ostrich cube.
What did he say?
Calypso asked. He said yes. From the counter, Calypso grabbed a paper menu with a map of the zoo on it. She pointed to an orange loop circling the plains area. Here. The loop was labeled Train Ride, the least creative name I could imagine. At the bottom, in a map key, was a more detailed explanation. Train Ride, a look at the zoo behind the zoo. Well, I said, at least they advertise the fact that they have a secret zoo behind the zoo. That was nice of them.
I think it's time to ride the choo-choo,
Calypso agreed.
From the front of the cafe came a crashing sound, like a Germanus had tripped over a trash can.
Stop that, barked Laterces. You, stay here and keep watch. If they show, capture them. Don't kill them. You, come with me. We need those griffins.
I counted silently to five, then whispered to Calypso.
Are they gone? Let me use my supervision to look through this wall and check, she said. Oh, wait. You are a terrible person.
She pointed to the map.
If Laterces left one guard at the crossroads, it will be difficult to get out of here and reach the train without him seeing us.
Well, I said, I suppose we could go back to the way station and tell Britta Martis that we tried.
Calypso threw a frozen golden tater tot at me.
When you were a god, if some heroes had returned empty-handed from a quest and told you, oh, sorry, Apollo, we tried, would you be understanding?
Certainly not. I would incinerate them. I would...
Oh, I see your point.
I wrung my hands.
Then what do we do?
I don't feel like being incinerated. It hurts.
Perhaps there's a way.
Calypso traced her finger across the map to a section labeled Meerkat, Reptile, and Snake,
which sounded like the worst law firm ever.
I have an idea, she said. Bring your tots and follow me.
14. Yeah, we got the skills. Fake hexes and shooting feet. Teach you about pancakes. I did not wish to follow Calypso, with or without my tots. Sadly, my only other option was to hide in the cafe until the Emperor's men found me, or the cafe manager arrived and impressed me into service as a short-order cook. Calypso led the way, darting from hiding place to hiding place like the urban ninja she was. I spotted the lone Germanus on sentry duty about 50 feet across the plaza, but he was busy studying the carousel. He pointed his pole arm warily at the painted horses, as if they might be carnivorous. We made it to the far side of the crossroads without attracting his attention. But I was still nervous. For all we knew, Latirces might have multiple groups sweeping the park. On a telephone pole near the souvenir shop, a security camera stared down at us. If the triumvirate was as powerful as Nero claimed, they could easily control surveillance inside the Indianapolis Zoo. Perhaps that was why Latirces was searching for us. He already knew we were here. I thought about shooting the camera with an arrow, but it was probably too late. Cameras loved me. No doubt my face was all over the security office monitors. Calypso's plan was to circumvent the orangutans and cut through the reptile display, skirting the park perimeter until we reached the train depot. Instead, as we passed the entrance to the ape habitat, voices of an approaching Germanus patrol startled us. We dove into the orangutan center for cover. All right, I got startled and dove for cover. Calypso hissed.
No, you idiot.
Then followed me inside. Together we crouched behind a retaining wall as two Germani strolled past, chatting casually about head-bashing techniques. I glanced to my right and stifled a yelp. On the other side of a glass wall, a large orangutan was staring at me, his amber eyes curious. He made some hand gestures. Sign language? Agamethus might have known. Judging from the great ape's expression, he was not terribly delighted to see me. Alas, among the great apes, only humans are capable of proper awe for the gods. On the plus side, for orangutans, they have amazing orange fur that no human could possibly rival. Calypso nudged my leg.
We need to keep moving.
We scurried deeper into the display room. Our simian movements must have amused the orangutan. He made a deep barking noise.
Shut up!
I stage whispered back at him. At the far exit, we huddled behind a curtain of camouflage netting. I cradled my taters and tried to steady my breathing. Next to me, Calypso hummed under her breath. A nervous habit of hers. I wished she would stop. Whenever she hummed a tune I knew, I had the urge to sing harmony very loudly, which would have given away our position. At last, I whispered,
I think the coast is clear.
I stepped out and smacked straight into another Germanus. Honestly, how many barbarians did Commodus have? Was he buying them in bulk? For a moment, all three of us were too surprised to speak or move. Then the barbarian made a rumbling sound in his chest, as if about to shout for backup. Hold these! I thrust my package of griffin food into his arms. Reflexively, he took them. After all, a man giving up his tots is a gesture of surrender in many cultures. He frowned at the package as I stepped back, slung my bow off my shoulder, fired, and planted an arrow in his left foot. He howled, dropping the tater tots package. I scooped it up and ran. Calypso close behind me.
Nicely done, she offered. Except for the fact that he probably alerted, Veer left!
Another Germanus came barreling out of the reptile area. We scrambled around him and ran toward a sign that said Skyline. In the distance loomed an aerial tram. Wires strung from tower to tower above the treetops. A single green gondola hanging about 50 feet in the air. I wondered if we could use the ride to reach the secret zoo area, or at least gain a height advantage. But the gondola house entrance was fenced off and padlocked. Before I could ask Calypso to work her hairpin hocus-pocus, the Germani cornered us. The one from the reptile area advanced, his pole arm leveled at our chests. The one from the orangutan house came snarling and limping behind, my arrow still sticking out of his bloody leather boot. I knocked another arrow, but there was no way I could bring them both down before they killed us. I'd seen Germani take 6 or 7 arrows to the heart and still keep fighting. Calypso muttered,
Apollo? When I curse you, pretend to faint.
What?
She wheeled on me and shouted, You have failed me for the last time, slave!
She made a series of hand gestures I recognized from ancient times. Hexes and curses that no one had ever dared to make in my direction. I was tempted to slap her. Instead, I did as she asked. I gasped and collapsed. Through my half-lidded eyes, I watched Calypso turn on our enemies.
Now it is your turn, fools!
She began making the same rude gestures toward the Germani. The first one stopped. His face paled. He glanced at me lying on the ground, then turned and fled, barreling past his friend. The Germanus with the wounded foot hesitated. Judging from the hatred in his eyes, he wanted revenge for the missile weapon that had ruined his left boot. Calypso, undaunted, waved her arms and began to incant. Her tone made it sound as if she were raising the worst diamonds from Tartarus. Though her words, in ancient Phoenician, were actually a recipe for making pancakes. The wounded Germanus yelped and hobbled away, leaving a trail of smeared red prints behind him. Calypso offered me a hand and pulled me up.
Let's move. I've only bought us a few seconds. Did your magic return?
I wish, she said. I faked it. Half of magic is acting like it will work. The other half is picking a superstitious mark. They'll be back, with reinforcements. I'll admit, I was impressed. Her hexing had certainly unnerved me. I made a quick gesture to ward off evil, just in case Calypso was better than she realized. Then we ran together along the perimeter fence. At the next crossroads, Calypso said,
This way to the train.
You're sure? She nodded. I'm good at memorizing maps. Once I made one of Ogygia, reproduced every square foot of that island. It was the only way I kept myself sane. This sounded like a terrible way to keep oneself sane, but I let her lead the way. Behind us, more Germani were shouting, but they seemed to be heading toward the skyline gates we'd just left. I allowed myself to hope that the train station might be clear. Ha, ha, ha. It was not. On the tracks sat a miniature train, a bright green steam engine with a line of open passenger cars. Next to it, on the station platform, under an ivy-covered canopy, Laterces stood with his feet planted, his unsheathed sword resting over his shoulder like a hobo's bindle. A battered leather cuirass was strapped over his cornhusker shirt. His dark, curly hair hung in tendrils over his red bandana, making it look as if a large spider were crouched on his head, ready to spring.
Welcome.
The prefect's smile might have seemed friendly, except for the cross-hatching of scars on his face. He touched something on his ear, a Bluetooth device, perhaps.
They're here at the station, he announced. Converge on me, but slow and calm. I'm fine. I want these two alive.
He shrugged at us apologetically.
My men can be overenthusiastic when it comes to killing, especially after you've made them look like fools.
It was our pleasure. I doubt I pulled off the self-assured, swashbuckling tone I was going for. My voice cracked. Sweat beaded on my face. I held my bow sideways like an electric guitar, which was not proper shooting stance. And in my other hand, instead of an arrow that might have been useful, I held a package of frozen tater tots. It was probably just as well. In my dream, I'd seen how rapidly Laterces could swing his sword. If I tried to fire on him, our heads would be rolling on the pavement before I drew back my bowstring. You're able to use a phone, I noticed. Or a walkie-talkie, or whatever that is. I hate it when the bad guys get to talk to each other and we can't. Laterces' laugh was like a file across metal.
Yes. The triumvirate likes to have certain advantages.
I don't suppose you'd tell us how they manage it, blocking demigod communications.
You won't live long enough for that to matter. Now, drop your bow. As for your friend, he sized up Calypso. Keep your hands at your side. No sudden curses.
I'd hate to chop off that pretty head of yours.
Calypso smiled sweetly. I was just thinking the same thing about you. Drop your sword, and I won't destroy you. She was a good actor. I made a mental note to recommend her to my Mount Olympus invitation-only summer camp, method acting with the muses. If we got out of this alive. Laterces chuckled.
That's good. I like you. But in about 60 seconds, a dozen Germani are going to swarm this depot. They will not ask as politely as I did.
He took a step forward and swung his sword to his side. I tried to think of a brilliant plan. Unfortunately, the only thing that came to mind was weeping in terror. Then, above Laterces, the ivy rustled on the canopy. The swordsman didn't seem to notice. I wondered if orangutans were playing up there. Or perhaps some Olympian gods had gathered for a picnic to watch me die. Or maybe. The thought was too much to wish for. But in the interest of buying time, I dropped my bow.
Apollo, Calypso hissed. What are you doing?
Laterces answered for me.
He's being smart. Now, where's the third member of your little party?
I blinked. It's just the two of us. Laterces' facial scars rippled, white lines on tan skin, like the ridges of a sand dune.
Come now. You flew into the city on a dragon. Three passengers. I very much want to see Leo Valdez again. We have unfinished business.
You know Leo? Despite the danger we were in, I felt a small sense of relief. Finally, some villain wanted to kill Leo more than he wanted to kill me. That was progress. Calypso didn't seem so happy. She stepped toward the swordsman with her fists clenched. What do you want with Leo? Laterces narrowed his eyes.
You're not the same girl who was with him before,
Her name was Piper.
You wouldn't happen to be Leo's girlfriend?
Red blotches appeared on Calypso's cheeks and neck. Laterces brightened.
Oh, you are? That's wonderful. I can use you to hurt him.
Calypso snarled. You will not hurt him. Above Laterces, the canopy roof shook again, as if 1,000 rats were scurrying through the rafters. The vines seemed to be growing, the foliage turning thicker and darker.
Calypso,
I said.
Step back. Why should I?
She demanded.
This corn husker just threatened. Calypso!
I grabbed her wrist and yanked her from the shadow of the canopy just as it collapsed on top of Laterces. The swordsman disappeared under hundreds of pounds of shingles, lumber, and ivy. I surveyed the mass of quivering vines. I saw no orangutans, no gods, no one who might have been responsible for the collapse.
She must be here,
I muttered.
Who?
Calypso stared at me with wide eyes.
What just happened?
I wanted to hope. I was afraid to hope. Whatever the case, we couldn't stay. Laterces was shouting and struggling under the wreckage, which meant he wasn't dead. His Germani would be here any second.
Let's get out of here.
I pointed to the green locomotive.
I'm driving.
15. Driving the green train. I'm all like, choo-choo, choo-choo. Can't catch me. Oh, poop. A slow-motion getaway was not what I had in mind. We both jumped onto the conductor's bench, which was barely wide enough for one, and jostled for space while punching pedals and turning random levers.
I told you I'll drive, I yelled. If I can drive the sun, I can drive this. This isn't the sun.
Calypso elbowed me in the ribs.
It's a model train.
I found the ignition switch. The train lurched into motion. Calypso will claim she found the ignition switch. This is a blatant lie. I pushed Calypso off the bench and onto the ground. Since the train was only going half a mile an hour, she simply stood up, brushed off her skirt, and walked alongside me, glaring.
That's top speed,
she demanded.
Push some more levers.
Behind us, from somewhere under the wreckage of the canopy, came a mighty blarg. Ivy shivered as Laterces tried to bust his way out. A half dozen Germani appeared at the far end of the platform. Commodus was definitely buying his barbarians by the Imperial family size pack. The bodyguard stared at the screaming mass of roof wreckage, then at us, choo-chooing away. Rather than give chase, they began clearing the beams and vines to free their boss. Given the progress we were making, they probably assumed they'd have plenty of time to come after us. Calypso hopped onto the running board. She pointed to the controls.
Try the blue pedal.
The blue pedal is never the right one. She kicked it with her foot. We shot forward at 3 times our previous speed, which meant our enemies would now have to jog at a moderate pace to catch us. The track curved as we continued to accelerate, our wheels squealing against the outer rail. The station disappeared behind a line of trees. On our left, the terrain opened up, revealing the majestic butts of African elephants who were picking through a pile of hay. Their zookeeper frowned as we trundled past.
Hey!
He yelled.
Hey!
I waved.
Morning.
Then we were gone. The cars shook dangerously as we picked up steam. My teeth clattered. My bladder sloshed. Up ahead, almost hidden behind a screen of bamboo, a fork in the track was marked by a sign in Latin. Bonum effersio.
There, I yelled. The good stuff. We need to turn left.
Calypso squinted at the console.
How?
There should be a switch, I said. Something that operates the turnout. Then I saw it. Not on our console, but ahead of us on the side of the tracks. An old-fashioned hand lever. There was no time to stop the train, no time to run ahead and turn the switch by hand.
Calypso, hold this!
I tossed her the tots and unslung my bow. I knocked an arrow. Once, such a shot would have been child's play for me. Now it was nearly impossible. Shooting from a moving train, aiming for a point where the focused impact of an arrow would have the maximum chance of triggering the switch. I thought of my daughter Kayla back at Camp Half-Blood. I imagined her calm voice as she coached me through the frustrations of mortal archery. I remember the other camper's encouragement the day on the beach when I'd made a shot that brought down the Colossus of Nero. I fired. The arrow slammed into the lever and forced it backward. The point blades shifted. We lurched onto the spur line.
Down!
Calypso yelled. We crashed through bamboo and careened into a tunnel just wide enough for the train. Unfortunately, we were going much too fast. The choo-choo tilted sideways, throwing sparks off the wall. By the time we shot out the other side of the tunnel, we were completely off balance. The train groaned and tilted, a sensation I knew well from those times the Sun Chariot had to veer to avoid a launching space shuttle or a Chinese celestial dragon. Those things are annoying.
Out!
I tackled Calypso. Yes, again, and leaped from the right side of the train as the line of cars spilled to the left, toppling off the tracks with a sound like a bronze-clad army being crushed by a giant fist. I may have crushed a few armies that way back in the old days. The next thing I knew, I was on all fours. My ear pressed against the ground as if listening for a herd of buffalo, though I had no idea why. Apollo, Calypso tugged at the sleeve of my coat. Get up. My throbbing head felt several times larger than usual, but I didn't seem to have broken any bones. Calypso's hair had come loose around her shoulders. Her silver parka was dusted with sand and bits of gravel. Otherwise, she looked intact. Perhaps our formerly divine constitutions had saved us from damage. Either that, or we were just lucky. We had crashed in the middle of a circular arena. The train lay curled sideways across the gravel like a dead caterpillar, a few feet shy of where the tracks ended. The perimeter was ringed with animal enclosures. Plexiglass walls framed in stone. Above that rose three tiers of stadium seating. Over the top of the amphitheater stretched a canopy of camouflage netting like I'd seen at the orangutan habitat. Though here I suspected the netting was meant to keep winged monsters from flying away. Around the arena floor, chains with empty manacles were fastened to spikes in the ground. Near these stood racks of sinister-looking tools. Cattle prods, noose poles, whips, harpoons. A cold lump formed in my throat. I would have thought I'd swallowed a griffin tater, except the packet was still miraculously intact in Calypso's arms. This is a training facility, I said. I've seen places like it before. These animals are being readied for the games.
Readied?
Calypso scowled at the weapon racks. How exactly? They're enraged, I said. Baited, starved, trained to kill anything that moves. Savagery. Calypso turned to the nearest pen. What have they done to those poor ostriches? Through the plexiglass, four of the birds stared at us, their heads jerking sideways in a series of fits. They were strange-looking animals to begin with, but these had been outfitted with rows of iron-studded collars along their necks, spiked war helmets in the Kaiser Wilhelm style, and razor wire wreathed like Christmas lights around their legs. The nearest bird snapped at me, revealing jagged steel teeth that had been fitted inside his beak. The Emperor's combat ostriches. I felt like a roof was collapsing inside my chest. The plight of these animals depressed me, but so did thinking about Commodus. The games he had engaged in as a young emperor were disagreeable to start with, and they had transformed into something much worse. He used to enjoy using them for target practice. With a single arrow, he could decapitate a bird running at a full gallop. Once that wasn't entertaining enough, I gestured at the enhanced war birds. Calypso's face turned jaundice yellow. All these animals will be killed? I was too dispirited to answer. I had flashbacks to the Flavian amphitheater during Commodus's rule. The glistening red sand of the stadium floor, littered with the carcasses of thousands of exotic animals, all butchered for sport and spectacle. We moved to the next enclosure. A large red bull paced restlessly, his horns and hooves gleaming bronze. That's an Ethiopian bull, I said. Their hides are impervious to all metal weapons. Like the Nemean lion, except, much larger and red. Calypso drifted past several more cells. Some Arabian-winged serpents. A horse that I judged to be of the carnivorous, fire-breathing variety. I once thought about using those for my sun chariot, but they were so high maintenance. The sorceress froze at the next window. Apollo, over here. Behind the glass were two griffins. Emmy and Josephine had been correct. They were magnificent specimens. Over the centuries, with their natural habitat shrinking, wild griffins had become scrawny creatures, smaller and scrappier than in ancient times. Much like the endangered three-eyed stoat or the giant gassy badger. Few griffins had ever been large enough to support the weight of a human rider. The male and female in front of us, however, truly were the size of lions. Their light brown fur gleamed like copper chainmail. Their russet wings folded regally across their backs. Their aquiline heads bristled with gold and white plumage. In the old days, a Grecian king would have paid a trireme full of rubies for a breeding pair like this. Thankfully, I saw no sign that the animals had been abused. However, both were chained by their back legs. Griffins get very cantankerous when they're imprisoned or restrained in any way. As soon as the male, Abelard, saw us, he snapped and squawked, flapping his wings. He dug his claws in the sand and strained against his shackle, trying to reach us. The female backed into the shadows, making a low, gurgling noise like the growl of a threatened dog. She swayed from side to side, her belly low to the ground as if... Oh, no. I feared my weak mortal heart would burst. No wonder Britomartis wanted these two back so badly. Calypso seemed entranced by the animals. With some difficulty, she refocused on me. What do you mean? The female is with egg. She needs to nest immediately. If we don't get her back to the way station.
Calypso's expression turned as sharp and steely as ostrich teeth.
Will Heloise be able to fly out of here?
I think so. My sister is more the expert on wild animals, but yes.
Can a pregnant griffin carry a rider?
We don't have much choice except to try.
I pointed at the netting above the arena.
That's the quickest way out, assuming we can unlock the griffins and remove the net.
The problem is, Heloise and Abelard are not going to see us as friends.
They're chained, they're caged, they're expecting a baby.
They'll tear us apart if we get close.
Calypso crossed her arms.
What about music? Most animals like music.
I recalled the way I had used a song to mesmerize the Myrmikas back at Camp Half-Blood. But I really didn't feel like singing about all my failures again, especially not in front of my companion.
I glanced back at the train tunnel. Still no sign of Laterces or his men, but that didn't make me feel better. They should have been here by now.
We need to hurry, I said.
The first problem was the easiest, the plexiglass wall. I reasoned there must be a switch somewhere for lowering the partitions to release the various animals. I climbed into the spectator tiers with the help of a stepladder named Calypso and found just such a control panel next to the arena's only padded seat. Clearly for the Emperor himself, when he wanted to check on his killer beasts in training. Each lever was conveniently labeled with masking tape and marker. One said griffins.
I called down to Calypso. Are you ready? She stood directly in front of the griffin enclosure, hands out as if preparing to catch a projectile egg.
What would constitute ready in a situation like this?
I flipped the switch. With a heavy ka-chunk, the griffin's plexiglass screen dropped away, disappearing into a slot across the threshold. I rejoined Calypso, who was humming some sort of lullaby. The two griffins were not impressed. Heloise growled loudly, pressing herself against the back wall of the enclosure. Abelard pulled at his chain twice as hard, trying to reach us and bite off our faces. Calypso handed me the packet of tots. She pointed with her chin into the enclosure. You must be kidding. I said. If I get close enough to feed them, they'll eat me. She stopped her song.
Aren't you the god of ranged weapons? Throw the tots!
I raised my eyes toward the netted-off heavens, which, by the way, I considered a rude and completely unnecessary metaphor for my exile from Olympus. Calypso, do you know nothing about these animals? To gain their trust, you must hand-feed them, putting your fingers inside the beak. This emphasizes that the food comes from you as the mother bird.
Huh.
Calypso bit her lower lip.
I see the problem. You would make a terrible mother bird.
Abelard lunged and squawked at me.
Everyone was a critic.
Calypso nodded as if she'd come to a decision.
It's going to take both of us. We'll sing a duet. You have a decent voice.
I have a... My mouth was paralyzed from shock. Telling me, the god of music, that I had a decent voice was like telling Shaquille O'Neal he played decent offense, or telling Annie Oakley she was a decent shot.
Then again, I was not Apollo. I was Lester Papadopoulos.
Back at camp, despairing of my puny mortal abilities, I had sworn an oath on the River Styx not to use archery or music until I was once again a god. I had promptly broken that oath by singing to the Myrmikas, for a good cause, mind you. Ever since, I had lived in terror, wondering when and how the spirit of the Styx would punish me.
Perhaps, instead of a grand moment of retribution, it would be a slow death by a thousand insults. How often could a music god hear that he had a decent voice before he crumbled into a self-loathing pile of dust? Fine, I sighed. Which duet should we sing? Islands in the Stream? Don't know it. I Got You, Babe? No. Dear gods, I'm sure we covered the 1970s in your pop culture lessons. What about that song Zeus used to sing? I blinked. Zeus? Singing? I found the concept mildly horrifying. My father thundered. He punished, he scolded. He glowered like a champion, but he did not sing. Calypso's eyes got a little dreamy. In the palace at Mount Othrys, when he was Cronus's cupbearer, Zeus used to entertain the court with songs. I shifted uncomfortably. I hadn't been born yet. I knew, of course, that Calypso was older than I, but I'd never really thought about what that meant. Back when the Titans ruled the cosmos, before the gods rebelled and Zeus became king, Calypso had no doubt been a carefree child. One of General Atlas's brood, running around the palace harassing the aerial servants. Ye gods. Calypso was old enough to be my babysitter. Surely you know the song. Calypso began to sing. Electricity tingled at the base of my skull. I did know the song. An early memory surfaced of Zeus and Leto singing this melody when Zeus visited Artemis and me as children on Delos. My father and mother, destined to be forever apart because Zeus was a married god. They had happily sung this duet. Tears welled in my eyes. I took the lower part of the harmony. It was a song older than empires, about two lovers separated and longing to be together. Calypso edged toward the griffins. I followed behind her. Not because I was scared to lead, mind you. Everyone knows that when advancing into danger, the soprano goes first. They are your infantry, while the altos and tenors are your cavalry, and the bass your artillery. I've tried to explain this to Ares a million times, but he has no clue about vocal arrangement. Abelard ceased yanking at his chain. He prowled and preened, making deep clucking sounds like a roosting chicken. Calypso's voice was plaintive and full of melancholy. I realized that she empathized with these beasts, caged and chained, yearning for the open sky. Perhaps, I thought,